During the same questions over and over again, Worden was coming home physically drained, sometimes arriving to a party in full swing in his apartment. He couldn't wind down until well past midnight. He was so overtired he couldn't sleep. Alone in his darkened living room, memories of the flight and the training came into his head, and he began to write about them. The words seemed to be coming from somewhere else. They flowed out of him. He began to jot down ideas, most not even complete sentences, page after page of them. It all came back. Seeing the universe revealed above the far side of the moon, the battered moon itself, a tiny crescent earth adrift in blackness. And then there was the spacewalk. In the middle of the voyage back to Earth, Worden had ventured outside Endeavour to retrieve cassettes of exposed film from the scientific cameras on the side of the service module, and he remembered every moment. A spacewalk is like being let out at night for a swim by Moby Dick. It was as if there were another debriefing he had to perform on himself, to give his mental computer a chance to play back the images and impressions he had stored up in space. It was the data the engineers didn't ask about. Over the weeks, he rewrote and rearranged the lines until they were poems, the poetry of a man caught in the lingering pull of another world. Quietly, like a night bird, floating, soaring, wingless, we glide from shore to shore, curving and falling, but not quite touching. Earth, a distant memory seen in an instant of repose. I glide upward above the waves of the ocean moon. She is forever moving just out of reach, and I sail on, never touching, only watching and wanting to know. In August 1971, NASA was on a high. With Apollo 15, the agency had scored its biggest success since the first lunar landing. Within the scientific community, even skeptics applauded the mission. Gary Wasserberg, a Caltech geochemist who had voiced his share of opposition to Lee Silver's astronaut training efforts, publicly named it one of the most brilliant missions in space science ever flown. For Dave Scott, there was an unaccustomed gesture of praise from a fellow astronaut, a note from Alan Bean congratulating him on a superb performance. And throughout the Space Center, there was the new realization that Apollo had reached maturity. Almost every one of Apollo 15's innovations, from the rover to the upgraded lunar module to the training and planning efforts, had come through with barely a hitch. The way was clear for the final two missions to be even more ambitious. And for six men, August was the moment of truth. The crew of Apollo 17, yet unnamed, was about to be announced. Six men eyed three seats on the final moon-bound command module. So did the scientific community. All through 1971, they had been turning up the heat on NASA, decrying the fact that NASA had a fully qualified scientist and wasn't sending him to the moon. Word of this filtered down to the astronaut office, where Dick Gordon had been making a hard run to snare Apollo 17 for his own. He knew very well that by Slayton's rotation, it was Gene Cernan, who had backed up Shepard on 14, who was in line for the mission. When Cernan crashed his helicopter in the Banana River during training, Gordon had hoped Cernan had taken himself out of the running, but that little episode had just slid off Cernan's back. Now, as the decision neared, Gordon was betting that Schmidt would be his edge, and he had no qualms about politicking for the flight. He went to Shepard and Slayton and asked them to keep his crew together. From the sidelines, the other astronauts watched and waited with great interest. There were two ways this could go, they realized. Even if Gordon didn't get the mission, Slayton could still take Schmidt and put him on Cernan's crew, in which case things were looking very bad for Cernan's lunar module pilot, Joe Engel. He was one of the most experienced test pilots among the original 19 and, in Cernan's mind, one of the best pilots he'd ever flown with. But Engel had a little of Gordon Cooper's strap-it-on-and-go attitude, and it had already hurt him. During Apollo 14, he had taken his role as backup lunar module pilot too casually. The computer and all its software routines was daunting enough to any astronaut, but Engel just wasn't applying himself. Tom Stafford, now the chief astronaut, was coming down on Cernan. "You're the commander of this goddamn crew. Get him in gear." And Cernan was telling the simulator instructors, "Whatever you can do to help, Joe, do it." But ultimately, it was up to Engel to change, and he didn't seem to realize how carefully his performance was being scrutinized. But in truth, Deke Slayton wasn't especially concerned. In his mind, only one thing mattered. It would have been unthinkable for NASA to have a geologist astronaut and not send him to the moon. August 12th. It was Thursday evening, and at the King's Inn Hotel on NASA Road 1, Jerry Schaber was listening to the evening news. Back in 1965, Jack Schmidt had hired Schaber to work at the USGS in Flagstaff. Over the years, they had become friends. Schaber had just come through one of the most exhilarating experiences he could remember, watching Scott and Irwin explore Hadley. "Nothing," he would say later, "could compare with seeing your friends go to the moon." But on this Thursday evening, Schaber's thoughts were on Jack Schmidt. The crew announcement was due any day now. Schaber was pessimistic. He couldn't imagine how Schmidt could get the flight when a popular pilot like Joe Engel was in line for it. He just bet his roommate Jim had $5 that Schmidt wouldn't make it. Suddenly, on television, the reporter was saying that the crew of Apollo 17 would include geologist-astronaut Jack Schmidt. Schaber yelled ahead, "Guess what they just said? Jack's on Apollo 17. Schaber picked up the phone to call Schmidt. "Hey, congratulations," Schaber said. "We just heard." The voice at the other end was characteristically gruff. "It's not true. I haven't heard anything from NASA, until NASA tells me I don't know anything about it." "Well, can we come over and help you wait for the call?" "I don't care." In the Nassau Bay apartments across from the manned spacecraft center, Jack Schmidt was sitting around by himself. One bedroom was still full of unopened boxes he'd brought with him from the survey in 1965. "Gee, Jack," said Head, "it's awful quiet around here for a guy who's going to the moon." "That's not true," Schmidt said. Head went over to the bar, opened his briefcase, and pulled out 5 small airline whiskey bottles. "What's that for?" asked Schmidt. "That's in case you get the right call," said Head. Suddenly the phone rang. It was Schmidt's sister calling from Silver City to congratulate him. Schmidt said, "It's not true." More waiting, and then the phone rang again. Suddenly, Schmidt got very quiet and businesslike. Schaber and Head looked at each other. "Yes, sir," they heard Schmidt say. "Yes, sir, I'll do the best job I can." Schmidt hung up the phone, went over to the bar, and very calmly unscrewed the caps from 3 of the little bottles of whiskey, picked them up together, and slugged them down. Schaber would always remember, with amazement, that no one from the Space Center called to congratulate Schmidt that night. He and Head ended up taking him out to a nearby Pizza Hut. Meanwhile, in Acapulco, a vacationing Ron Evans was scuba diving with his daughter Jamie, and when they came out of the water, there was the rest of his family and Gene Cernan and his family all excited. Deke Slayton had just called with wonderful news. The children made a banner and strung it across the cabana. It said, "Apollo 17. But on both sides of the border there were pangs of sadness, as the ones who made it thought about the ones who didn't. The next day, Jack Schmidt said to Dick Gordon, "Why don't you let me talk to Deke?" "No, I've had my shot," Gordon said. "The decision's been made." Schmidt went to Slayton anyway and asked him not to break up the crew. He and Gordon had worked very well together, he said. They made a great team. But his effort was in vain. Slayton wasn't going to change his decision. In the days that followed, Schmidt also spoke with Joe Engel. It was an awkward time. Engel was visibly upset, and Schmidt could tell he was bitter. But Engel handled himself as well as could be expected. He told a reporter that the toughest thing he could remember doing in a long time was explaining to his kids that he wasn't going to the moon. Chapter 12. The Unexpected Moon, Apollo 16. 1. Luna Incognita. The moon that shone down on Houston in the spring of 1972 looked exactly the same as it had throughout human history. No telescope in existence could have picked up any sign that 4 teams of explorers had landed there, disturbed the stillness of the ages and picked up rocks. But in the minds of the geologists who were analyzing those rocks, now totaling almost 385 pounds, the miles of photographic film taken on the surface and from orbit, and the rest of Apollo's burgeoning harvest of data, it was a world transformed. The moon of speculation was giving way to the moon of fact, and in many respects it was just as the geologists had theorized. The impact origin of most lunar craters, the formation of the Maria by volcanic eruptions, and the existence of an anorthosite primordial crust had all been confirmed, though the details of these features would continue to be debated. Knowing how lunar features formed was only one goal of the geologists. It was just as important to know when. With each new landing, the scientists had added more dates to their timeline of lunar history. Apollo 11 and 12 had given them the times of two different episodes of Mare volcanism, and Apollo 14 gave them the best chance yet to look back before the Mare eruptions to the moon's youth, and they saw an era of almost unimaginable violence. This was the period of heavy bombardment, when giant asteroids collided with the moon to form the impact basins. The bombardment came to an end when a chunk of debris the size of Rhode Island slammed into the moon, creating the Imbrium Basin, 720 miles across, the largest and most spectacular crater on the lunar near side. Debris ejected from the impact appeared to have gouged, blanketed, or otherwise altered terrain for perhaps hundreds of miles around. The Fra Mauro Hills were just one result. Even before Apollo, the geologists had realized that the date of that cataclysm, which reshaped so much of the near side, would be among the most important points on the timeline. With Apollo 14, they found it. The rocks from Cone Crater gave a shaky but still usable date of 3.85 billion years. At Hadley Delta, which, along with the rest of the Apennines, formed the basin's rim, Scott and Irwin found rocks at Spur Crater that confirmed this age, and thanks to the Genesis rock, they could look back even further. Before Apollo, no one had anticipated that the moon's primordial crust would be made of anorthosite, and many scientists still questioned the theory of a global magma ocean. But the idea was becoming harder and harder to refute. Data from the sensors in Apollo 15's orbiting service module confirmed that anorthosite was a widespread component of the lunar highlands. As the geologists were coming to understand the lunar surface, other scientists were lifting the veil of mystery from the interior. Including the ALSEP package at Hadley Base, there were now three fully equipped scientific stations scattered across the near side. Their seismometers were sending back data on tiny moonquakes caused by the pounding from small meteorites, and bigger ones triggered by the intentional crashes of spent lunar modules and Saturn boosters. For geophysicists, the shock waves from those quakes provided soundings of the moon's rocky depths. They revealed a crust some 40 miles thick, undoubtedly with variations from one region to another. Below the crust lies the lunar mantle, the source of the Mare basalts. By analyzing those samples, the geochemists had determined that their source regions in the lunar mantle contained iron and magnesium-rich rocks. By all signs, the mantle had cooled down enough to bring an end to the moon's volcanic activity eons ago. But was there a molten core farther down? Instruments had failed to detect a magnetic field apart from traces of magnetic signatures preserved in some of the rocks. The Earth's magnetic field is thought to arise from motions within a core made of hot metallic fluid. By implication, the moon was probably fairly cool throughout. This was where lunar research stood by the spring of 1972. There were many questions remaining, most notably about the composition and evolution of the highlands, the last great lunar unknown accessible to Apollo. Their lure was undeniable. The Mare Plains were the slate on which the last 3.6 billion years of lunar history was most clearly written, but only the battered highlands might contain a record of everything that came before. Sending astronauts to the ancient highlands had been one of the geologists' top priorities. The hills of Fra Mauro did not qualify, since their record of lunar history went no farther back than the Imbrium impact. To sample the oldest highlands, the astronauts would have to travel beyond the reach of Imbrium's extensive blanket of ejecta. One such landing site, one of the few that could be called a favorite of nearly all the geologists, was Magnificent Tycho, the freshest large crater in the southern highlands and one of the most distinctive features on the lunar near side. A sharp, unaided eye can spot Tycho from Earth. Its rays of ejecta stretch almost all the way across the full moon. On lunar orbiter photos, giant boulders, torn from the depths of the highland crust, were visible along the rim of the 51-mile diameter crater. Nearby, nestled among the hills, were ponds of once molten rock that would make fine landing places for a lunar module. In January 1968, the final Surveyor probe had successfully touched down in one of these valleys. When it came time to choose a landing site for Apollo 16, the geologists pushed hard for Tycho, but their campaign hit a wall when NASA got a look at the hellishly rugged terrain that lay underneath the approach path to the landing site. Jim McDivitt, now the manager of the Apollo spacecraft program office, saw the lunar orbiter photos and said flatly, "You will go to Tycho over my dead body." McDivitt's reluctance was compounded by the fact that Tycho was hundreds of miles away from the lunar equator. Getting there would take much more energy than previous missions. That would mean cutting down on Apollo 16's scientific payload. And more importantly, the trajectory necessary to reach Tycho was so far outside the free return that if the command module were disabled en route, an Apollo 13-type rescue would stretch the LM's fuel reserves uncomfortably far. Tycho was a risk NASA would not take. Instead, after some debate, the geologists chose a patch of hills west of the Sea of Nectar and not far from the 30-mile crater Descartes. Unlike Tycho, the Descartes Highlands would probably not provide pieces of the ancient crust, which the geologists still hoped to sample on Apollo 17. But the geologists believed Descartes would yield an equally important prize, something no other place in the highlands seemed to offer, volcanic rocks. The reason the geologists were willing to bank an entire mission on the premise of volcanic rocks was simple. They are the only direct means of knowing what has happened in a planet's interior. The Mare basalts proved that the lunar mantle had once been partly molten, and that was tantamount to saying that the moon had been geologically alive. But those samples were only part of the story. The maria covered only 17% of the moon. Furthermore, the basalts brought back to Earth had formed during a fairly narrow 350 million year window of the moon's 4.6 billion year history. If volcanic rocks could be found in the highlands, the geologists hoped they might unlock greater expanses of lunar history before and after the Mare eruptions. In short, they would tell the geologists how full the moon's geologic life had been. Many of the mappers who studied pictures of the Descartes Highlands saw ample evidence for volcanism. To these geologists, the shapes of the mountains suggested that they had been formed from lava, but one of different composition than found in the Maria. On Earth, basalt lavas are relatively thin and runny. They spread across the land like oil on a tabletop. Lavas whose composition is more like granite, on the other hand, are thick, like toothpaste. The difference is silica content. Because granite has more silica, it is more viscous. Not only would such lavas produce landforms like those at Descartes, they would be lighter in color than basalts, just as the lunar highlands are lighter than the Maria. When the geologists looked at the Descartes Mountains, elongate mountains with rounded tops and irregular shapes, they saw silica-rich volcanic rocks, which had never been found on the moon. Perhaps the mountains were made of rhyolite, the volcanic equivalent of granite, or maybe they were piles of silica-rich volcanic ash and cinders. Between the mountains, meanwhile, were patches of smooth plains that resembled other lunar regions that the geologists called the Cayley Formation. They, too, were almost certainly volcanic deposits. They might even be the highlands' ancient version of Mare basalt, brightened due to the effects of meteorite bombardment over the eons. In any case, Descartes seemed to offer what the geologists had long hoped for, a window into the evolution of the highlands. The scientists who had mapped the area believed some of its features might date back to almost 4 billion years, while others had formed only 1 billion years ago, fully 2 eons after the Mare eruptions. Descartes was not only easy to reach, it appeared to lie beyond Imbrium's influence. For the geologists, Descartes was too good to pass up. And on April 16, 1972, when veteran moon voyager John Young and his crew, rookies Ken Mattingly and Charlie Duke, headed out of Earth orbit, their primary goal was to make known Apollo's last luna incognita. Thursday, April 20th, 1972, 1:27 p.m. Houston time. 4 days, 1 hour, 33 minutes mission elapsed time, aboard the command module Casper. It's my fault. I've come all this way, and people have put all this time and money and effort into this, and I've managed to screw it up. Even as these thoughts flashed through Ken Mattingly's mind, he forced himself to focus on the job. Young and Duke were out there, drifting away from him, heading for their powered descent. And he was flying solo, getting ready to fire up his SPS engine and change Casper's orbit from an ellipse with a high point of 69 miles and a low point of 9 miles, the so-called descent orbit, to a circle 69 miles above the moon. He'd routed electrical power to the engine and turned on the gyros, and it was all normal until he tested the secondary control system. There was a set of little thumb wheels that controlled the gimbal motors for the engine nozzle, and as soon as he touched the yaw thumb wheel, he felt Casper begin to shake. On the instrument panel in front of him, the 8-ball nodded back and forth. He pulled back his hand and the shaking stopped. He changed some switch settings and tried it again. More shaking. It felt like a train on a very bad track. He said aloud, "It's not going to work." Once more, he switched settings and moved the thumb wheel. No change. He spoke to the empty cabin. "I'd be a sorry bird." Was it his fault? He knew he was doing everything just the way he'd done it 100 times in the simulator. And yet, how could something have gone wrong with this beautiful flying machine that had worked perfectly for 4 days? Back at the Cape, a few weeks before the launch, he'd gone to the pad just to look at the Saturn V, and he'd realized, as he gazed at the towering machine, that he barely knew what he was looking at. Sure, he understood the basic design, and he knew the parts and pieces he had to know, but there were, what, several million parts in the whole thing? And each one had been designed, fabricated, tested, and installed by someone. Standing there, he knew the scope of Apollo was beyond the grasp of any one mind. He rode the elevator up to the place where the third stage met the spacecraft adapter section, and there, at the juncture, was an open hatchway. He climbed through until he was standing inside a great metallic ring lined with pipes and electrical lines and all kinds of components. The lone technician who was working in there was startled. "Who are you? Get out of here." But once he understood that he was talking to one of the men who would ride this rocket, he was just as gracious as he could be. He said to Mattingly, "You know, I can't imagine what it's going to be like for you, but I can tell you this, it won't fail because of what I do." Mattingly realized that the reason Apollo worked at all was because thousands of people had said to themselves, "It won't fail because of me." From that moment on, Mattingly had taken that statement as his credo. He told himself as launch day grew near, and then, lying on his back in the command module, just before the engines lit, "It won't fail because of me." How could he not feel the weight of the mission on him now? "Hey, Orion." "Go ahead, Ken." John Young's voice. "I have an unstable yaw gimbal number 2. "Oh, boy." John Young, the last active member of the New 9, was the most experienced man in the astronaut office. He'd even been here before, the first man to make 2 trips into lunar orbit. He knew more about spaceflight than anyone Mattingly could think of. If only he were here right now, Mattingly thought, he might know how to work around this. but he was several thousand feet away. He couldn't see the engine. He couldn't feel Casper shake when he touched the gimbal control. To Mattingly went the honor of being the first astronaut to face a crisis alone over the far side of the moon. He asked his commander, "You got any quick ideas?" "No, I sure don't." More than most astronauts, Mattingly thought, John Young seemed mindful of the risks of his profession. Around the astronaut office, his memos were well known, sounding the alarm about some engineering problem he'd uncovered. He wouldn't rest until he knew every detail about the particular system or technique that worried him, and when he had learned all he could, then it was time to go fly, with his eyes wide open. That was the only way to handle this business. That was what made him so good. Maybe Young worried so much because he saw so clearly. But when it came down to the real question, "Will you fly it?" John's answer would always be yes, and Mattingly could understand. He felt the same way. Maybe that's why he liked John Young so much. Now Mattingly heard Charlie Duke's familiar drawl. "Hey, Ken, why don't you just stop it and start it again?" "I've done that twice." Mattingly knew his role as command module pilot. He was a truck driver. Get the big boys out to the moon, drop them off, and get them home. Secretly, he'd always wished something would go wrong so he could show how good he was. Let the LM's ascent rocket give out before Young and Duke could reach him. He'd go get them. Let the computer fail on the way back to Earth. He'd get them home with a pencil and a few directions from mission control. But not this. Failure, Mattingly had always thought, was supposed to be clear-cut. It works or it doesn't. This was a gray area. Was the engine control really broken? The nozzle moved, after all. It just shook a lot. Could he still make a burn with it? He had no idea, and as much as he wanted to do something to save the mission, he knew that if he went ahead and tried to make the burn and the engine didn't work right, he would have made a very bad decision. Now he heard Duke again. "What do your rules say, Ken?" Mattingly knew what the mission rules said. There'd been a change about a week before launch, and Mattingly was so mad about a change that late that he almost didn't read it. Now he wished he hadn't read it. It said that all four thrust vector control circuits, primary and secondary, had to be working or else the circ burn was forbidden. The only thing to do was rendezvous with Orion, come around to the near side, and get word from Houston. Mission control agreed. Young and Duke would have to take a wave off on the landing attempt, rendezvous with Mattingly, and fly in formation until there was some answer. That would be difficult. The onboard computers weren't programmed for the subtle nuances of orbital mechanics required to bring together a command module and lunar module that were flying in the same orbit, less than a mile apart. Mattingly would have to brute force it, just point Casper at the lunar module and fire the thrusters. That would cost lots of maneuvering fuel, but there wasn't any other choice. The hours dragged on as Casper and Orion circled the moon in limbo, waiting for Houston's decision. Mattingly doubted they'd find a way out. If only they could have said, "You guys get back together, we'll figure this out and try again tomorrow." But that was out of the question. The sun was rising over the Descartes Highlands, and by tomorrow the lighting conditions would be no good for a landing. They would have to solve this today or call off the mission. "Casper, we'd like you to..." Jim Irwin was telling Mattingly to try the gimbal motors again. Mission control would record the telemetry and show it to the SPS experts. He could picture what was going on in Houston right now. Apollo spacecraft program manager Jim McDivitt, overseeing the troubleshooting effort, phone lines to Downey and to MIT, engineers poring over data, and he knew, after witnessing Apollo 13, that given enough time, the experts on Earth could solve any problem. But they couldn't possibly have enough time on this one. Mattingly was sure the mission was over. And he could tell by the dejected tone in Young and Duke's voices that they thought so too. The funny thing was, Mattingly had a feeling he knew what might be wrong. A long time ago, he'd heard about a test of the engine in which the cable that carried signals to and from the gimbal motors was a little too short. When the nozzle was pointed to one side, the cable went taut and pulled some pins out of its electrical connector. Mattingly wondered if that's what had happened to the secondary control system. And if so, then how could he be sure the primary system was okay? All the control signals went through the same cable. No point in worrying Young and Duke about this, he kept the thought to himself. As Casper and Orion circled the moon, Mattingly wondered just how much of his spacecraft really worked. He knew that if they had to, he and his crewmates could use the lander's engine to get out of lunar orbit. Was that what they were getting ready to do? Was this mission really over? Mission Operations Control Room. In the back row of Mission Control, Jim McDivitt waited for Casper and Orion to come back around from the far side of the moon for the 15th time. McDivitt had been the manager of the Apollo Spacecraft Program Office for 3 years now, having taken the job after coming home from Apollo 9. Often, during the missions, he had decided whether or not to continue after emergencies struck. On Apollo 12, it had been his recommendation to leave Earth orbit after the lightning strike. Apollo 13 had been his ordeal as much as anyone's at NASA. On the flight, Al Shepard had thought might be trouble-free. McDivitt had faced Apollo 14's problems with a balky docking mechanism and then, hours away from powered descent, an errant abort signal. Now it was McDivitt's turn again, as Apollo 16 hung in the balance. There were some astronauts who would keep flying as long as you let them. No one more than John Young, but not McDivitt. There were only 4 ways to get out of this business. Get grounded, get fired, get killed, or retire. In McDivitt's mind, the only good choice was the last one. But if he waited too long, it would be one of the other 3. After commanding Apollo 9, which had been enough of a test for any astronaut, he knew he would probably command one of the later lunar landings, but he had never viewed going to the moon as an end in itself. He would have stayed to fly the first landing, but not the 4th. He had always wanted to manage a big program, preferably in government, where there would be more control. When the program office wanted him, he felt it would be the best use of his abilities. Now, 3 years later, he had no regrets. But the job had taxed him in ways that flying never had. Tracking lunar modules and command modules as they went through manufacturing and testing, shipment to the Cape, and final checkout for launch, and making sure everything happened on schedule to meet each new launch window, was as complex as anything he'd ever done. He could fully appreciate now the awesome responsibilities faced by Kraft, Petroni, and the other Apollo managers. He'd never forgotten that going to the moon was dangerous, but in his mind, NASA accepted that fact the moment the Saturn V left the pad, with each successive step, leaving Earth orbit, getting out to the moon, going into lunar orbit, and finally landing, the danger increased, but so did the investment in terms of risk to get there. Now that Young's crew were circling the moon, McDivitt was prepared, as long as they were safe, to fight even harder to keep them going than he would have if they'd been in Earth orbit. A short time ago, McDivitt had looked at the strip charts of the telemetry from Casper, and it appeared that despite the oscillations, steering signals were getting through to the engine. At Downey, engineers had been analyzing the data and feeding it into a mock-up of the SPS. They concluded that if Mattingly had to use the secondary system, the engine might shake, but it would be controllable. Was their data enough? McDivitt needed an extra measure of confidence, and as he had many times in this job, he got it from his own experiences on Apollo 9. In one of the many what-if exercises of that engineering test flight, they'd caused the SPS engine to shake while it was being fired, and it had still performed well. Just now, while Casper and Orion were behind the moon, McDivitt had met with Kraft and the other managers and told them it was safe to proceed, and once more, having taken the risk of sending men to the moon, NASA was about to make good on its investment. 5:55 p.m. Mattingly couldn't believe it when Irwin called up and said they'd looked at the test data and figured out that everything would be okay. Whoever was responsible for this spectacular save, Mattingly was going to buy them a case of beer. But didn't they realize that the primary system might be out too? Well, if their judgment said go ahead, he wasn't about to argue, not after 6 years of working his tail off to get here. He marveled at the boldness that seemed to have filled the managers after more than a decade in this business. When he was back on Earth, Mattingly would tell McDivitt that he couldn't believe he let the mission continue, not when both of those control lines went through the same cable, and McDivitt would tease, "We didn't know they went through the same cable. You're the only one who did. You're right, we wouldn't have let you land." 8:23 p.m. in the lunar module Orion. "Okay, 80 feet down at 3, looking super. There's dust." Orion sank straight down toward the Descartes Highlands, kicking up wisps of bright soil. John Young kept his gaze out the window while Charlie Duke gave him data. "Let her on down. 6%, plenty fat." If the past several hours had been rough on Ken Mattingly, they'd been even more traumatic for Young and Duke. Before undocking, Orion had an antenna problem, and then, because of a failed regulator, a dangerous buildup of pressure in the tanks of maneuvering fuel that threatened to abort the flight until Houston suggested shunting propellant into the ascent engine tanks, and then came the wave off. They circled the moon, feeling their mission slipping away from them. But now, 6 hours behind schedule, Young and Duke were going to have their landing. Orion was flying just like the LLTV at Ellington, and after edging past one last 50-foot crater, the lander thumped to a stop. Charlie Duke, never one to restrain his excitement, couldn't contain himself. "Wow! Whoa, man! Old Orion is finally here, Houston! Fantastic!" "Well," drawled Young, "we don't have to walk far to pick up rocks, Houston. We're among them." Friday, April 21st, 10:57 a.m. Houston time. 4 days, 23 hours, 3 minutes mission elapsed time. Descartes Highlands. "Hey, John, hurry up." "I'm hurrying," said John Young as he made his way down Orion's ladder. And then, for a moment, as he stood at last in the lunar sun, he raised both fists in triumph. "There you are, our mysterious and unknown Descartes Highland Plains. Apollo 16 is going to change your image." No one listening on Earth knew how prophetic those words would turn out to be. Young added, "I'm glad they got old Brer Rabbit here back in the briar patch where he belongs." Years later, Young would be reluctant to explain the quote, but it seems clear that Brer Rabbit is himself, and the briar patch is spaceflight. Even now, on his fourth space mission, he showed no signs of wanting to do anything else, but Young hardly looked the part of a seasoned spacecraft commander. One day, a simulator instructor was showing a friend around the Space Center, and when he pointed out Young across the room, this rumpled little guy in a Banlon shirt and jeans, the reaction was, "He's an astronaut?" Even people who worked for the NASA contractors didn't know what to make of him. He drawled his way through conversation and gave the impression he was still the quiet country boy who grew up in Orlando, Florida, back when it was mostly farmland. You could see them sizing him up. "This poor guy just isn't on top of it. I'll have to go slow here." But before the day was over, they learned differently. Young would sit through a presentation on the computer software without saying a word. And when the specialist had finished, he'd drawl, "Well, I don't know about the W matrix or anything like that, but what gets me is, how come if that's true, when I do this, I get this?" And you could almost hear the floorboards falling away in the engineer's mind as he thought it through. Hey, he's right! Some people saw the country boy bit as an act. It wasn't. It was just John's way of getting the people around him to think a little harder about the problem. In any case, you only made the mistake once. John Young was no hayseed. Ken Mattingly would call Young one of the best read people he had ever met. His sharp, intuitive approach to engineering problems was well known to his colleagues. Inside Young was an unwavering determination, an overriding sense of responsibility. to the space program, to the country, to his crew, and an almost childlike sense of wonder at the universe. When it came to lunar field geology, Young had caught the spark from Lee Silver, beginning on that first trip to the Orocopias with Lovell and Hayes, and he hadn't lost it. At that time, he and Charlie Duke had been looking forward to Apollo 16 as the first J mission. In 1970, the pair were doing practice geology work at the USGS training site in Flagstaff when they found out they would lose that milestone to Dave Scott's crew. It was a tremendous disappointment. Now they were faced with the task of equaling or even surpassing Apollo 15's scientific haul, and Young was ready. Oh, look at all those beautiful rocks. Science Operations Room, Manned Spacecraft Center. In the geology back room, William Mulberger inspected a photo map of the Descartes Highlands, ready to oversee his surface geology team. He was new at this game, and he'd had a very stressful 24 hours. The geologists had done their share of sweating during the wave-off. Then, during the night, they'd learned that because of the late landing, the managers wanted to cancel the third moonwalk, and Mulberger had set his planning team to work on a position paper to convince them to keep it. They were up all night, and in the morning they made their case. The managers were persuaded, but the go-ahead would depend on whether Young and Duke could stretch their supplies of power, oxygen, and cooling water to allow it. Now, beneath his excitement that Young and Duke were finally about to face the mysteries of the Descartes Highlands, Mulberger worried that they might not have time to unravel them. Mulberger's tall and powerful form recalled his days on the football team at Caltech, where he had been a classmate of Lee Silver's. Unlike the disheveled, lived-in look of some geologists, Mulberger was a picture of neatness. He was almost dapper. A professor at the University of Texas, Mulberger had joined the Apollo geology effort after Apollo 14. For Apollo 16, he had taken over not only as chief of the surface geology team, but for Young and Duke's geology training. Lee Silver had been too busy with his work on Apollo 15, not to mention his teaching load at Caltech. Now, seated at the back of the science operations room, Mulberger listened to the voices of his former students coming from the moon. Since the preparations for Apollo 16 began, Mulberger had heard more about the volcanic interpretation of the Descartes Highlands than he could remember. One of the unique aspects of Apollo's lunar explorations was that the geologists had to predict what the astronauts would find at each landing site long before the flight began. That wasn't the way Mulberger or most other geologists were used to doing business, but NASA wanted the geologic objectives to be as carefully planned as any other aspect of the missions, and it would have been out of the question to convey any uncertainty to the managers. Had he or his colleagues stood up at a site selection meeting and said, "We're really not sure what we'll find," they would have weakened their position and possibly even lost the chance to go to Descartes. Just as on previous missions, the geologists had made their predictions about Descartes using the discipline of photogeology. In this effort, their basic tools were their eyes, their minds, and photographs of the moon, along with knowledge gained from unmanned probes and the previous Apollo landings. Mulberger knew that there were scientists in other fields who had nothing but disdain for photogeology. To them, any research that based its conclusions on photographs, or even worse, visual observations, was second-rate at best. Even some geologists agreed with them, but neither they nor anyone else could offer an alternative. There wasn't one, save going there, and each new mission seemed to confirm photogeology's predictive powers. The last four landings had given their share of surprises, but they had also validated a lot of good, solid scientific effort. But with Descartes, the geologists were at a disadvantage. The best pictures available were the ones Stu Roosa took when Apollo 14's HiCon camera failed. For all of Roosa's skill, the smallest details they showed were calculated at 66 feet across. The challenge of analyzing Roos's pictures went to USGS geologists Don Elston and Jean Boudet, who subjected the pictures to the most intensive scrutiny imaginable, magnifying them under stereographic plotters. Elston and Boudet charted details that weren't much bigger than the grains in the film, including boulders they said were about 16 feet across. After a heroic effort, their finished map was dotted with all kinds of volcanic features, from lava flows to cinder cones to explosion craters. Mulberger was amazed. Sometimes, when he looked into Elston and Boudet's stereo plotters, he wondered why he couldn't see the tiny details they talked about. But he knew Elston and Boudet had been at this for years, and they seemed sure of their conclusions. In fact, out of all the geologists, they were the most enthusiastic about the volcanic hypothesis. Mulberger had had second thoughts about that scenario. After all, some experts had expected volcanic rocks to turn up at Fra Mauro, and none did. But he never really questioned the interpretation. And if others on his team harbored doubts about volcanics in the Descartes Highlands, they hadn't voiced them loud enough for him to hear. The late landing had thrown everything into disarray. Already they'd lost the chance to have Young and Duke take telephoto pictures of Stone Mountain in the early morning light to find out whether it had a pattern of linear grooves like Mount Hadley, and whether it might be an illusion caused by lighting conditions. But today's excursion was packed with objectives, and as Mulberger listened to the voices of his two students, he heard the most exuberant pair yet to reach the surface of the moon.
"Hot dog, is this great! That first step on the lunar surface is super!"
No surprise that Charlie Duke should be so excited. He was often that way, like an overgrown kid. On the field trips, Mulberger had heard him chattering away in his South Carolina drawl, while John Young mumbled in the background in a steady stream of one-liners. The grind of training seemed to bring out the vaudeville in them. Now, on the moon, it was the John and Charlie show all over again. Presently, Duke was doing his impression of W.C. Fields.
"Here's the old photo map, just like training. A picture of Hadley Rill."
Young, meanwhile, was setting up a telescopic camera to photograph ultraviolet radiation from stars, and was discovering how much fun it was to handle the instrument, which was heavy and cumbersome on Earth, in lunar gravity. Young's normal reticence was gone.
"Look at that, Charlie. Look at me carry it. I'm carrying it over my shoulder. Ha ha ha!"
Soon the rover's TV camera was on, and everyone on Earth could see the pair in action. They had planted the American flag, and now Duke was composing a picture of his commander.
"Hey, John, this is perfect, with the LM and the rover and you and Stone Mountain and the old flag. Come on out here and give me a big Navy salute."
Young did just that, and he did it while jumping 3 feet off the ground. 1:07 p.m., Science Operations Room. Mark Langseth, a tall man in his 30s with brown hair, wire-rimmed glasses and long sideburns, had taken a seat next to Jim Lovell to watch Charlie Duke drill into the moon. It was customary, during an ALSEP deployment, for a principal investigator to take this seat while watching his experiment being deployed. Langseth, a geophysicist at Columbia University, had been working for 6 years to find out how much heat was flowing from the lunar interior. His experiment had been aboard Apollo 13. It burned up, along with Aquarius, in the atmosphere. At Hadley Base, Dave Scott's best efforts hadn't succeeded in getting the thermometers down to the desired 10-foot depth. Langseth got his readings, but the temperatures were twice as high as he expected. Only new data from another location would let him interpret the Apollo 15 results. Langseth was especially eager to see whether the heat flow would be different in the highlands, and it looked as if he was going to get what he wanted. Duke had the benefit of a redesigned drill, and even the moon seemed to be cooperating.
"Look at that beauty go," Duke raved.
Within minutes, the hole was drilled and the thermometer inserted to its full depth. Duke beamed.
"Mark has his first one all the way into the red mark on the Cayley Plains."
Langseth beamed, too.
"Outstanding," said Capcom Tony England, "the first one in the highlands."
To which John Young quipped,
asking what we're going to do if the temperature shows like it does at Hadley. Young was working on the OSAP, standing among the sensitive instruments and their ribbons of electronic cable. The camera was pointed at him now as he started to walk away from the central station. Langseth saw something wrong. He nudged Lovell and said, "Look, he's got the cable around his foot." Before Lovell could call mission control, everyone saw it pull free of the central station. Judging from the cable's position, Langseth thought it must belong to the seismometer, but that thought didn't last long. "Charlie?" Young's voice was almost plaintive.
"What?"
"Something happened here."
"What happened?"
"I don't know. Here's a line that pulled loose." Duke, who had been drilling the hole for the second heat flow probe, stopped and looked toward Young.
"Uh-oh."
Young sounded worried.
"What is that? What line is it?"
"That's the heat flow. You pulled it off." Langseth couldn't believe what he was hearing. Neither could John Young.
"I don't know how it happened. God almighty."
"Well," Duke said flatly, "I'm wasting my time."
"God, I'm sorry. I didn't even know it."
You could hear it in Young's voice. He really had no idea it was happening. Like any moonwalker, Young could not easily see his own feet as he walked. For one thing, the small chest-mounted control unit was in his way, and also he had to lean unnaturally far forward to compensate for the mass of his backpack. And it was well known that the ALSEP cables developed a memory from being rolled up, and once unrolled they refused to lay flat in 1/6 G. That was something Young and Duke had noticed in training, and they'd warned the engineers about it, but that didn't matter now. Cocooned within his suit, Young never felt the ribbon snag on his boot, pull taut, and sever, crippling Langseth's experiment.
"Tell Mark we're sorry," Duke said. "Is there no way we can recover from that, Tony?"
"I'm sure we're working it," England said.
It was true. Even now, as a stunned Langseth absorbed what had happened, experts were coming together to see if it was realistic to try a repair. 3:04 p.m., Science Operations Room. Bill Mulberger studied the photo map, tracing Young and Duke's progress as they drove west on their first geology traverse. With only a couple of hours available, the men would just have time to drive to some relatively nearby craters and get their first samples of the Cayley Plains. For months, Mulberger and his team had speculated on what the Cayley Plains would be like. Today, in TV pictures that were even clearer than Apollo 15's transmissions, they were seeing it. Old Orion had set down in a small inlet between two mountains that were aligned roughly north-south, like the peninsulas of San Francisco. On the monitors in the back room, the place did not appear to be very different from Hadley Base. There was the same expanse of undulating, crater-pocked, gray desert, and in the background there were mountains, not as distinct of a skyline as the Apennines, but similar in their rounded form. But if the geologists' ideas were correct, the similarities were deceptive. Those mountains, like the plains, were made of volcanic rock. But so far, Young and Duke hadn't found what everyone expected. The first rock Duke picked up, back at the ALSEP site, had not been a piece of rhyolite, or basalt, or any other volcanic rock. It had been a breccia, an impact rock. A breccia is a mixture of rock fragments and soil particles welded together by the enormous energy of a meteorite impact. Ever since Gene Shoemaker had found breccias at Meteor Crater, geologists had expected to find them on the moon. Sure enough, minor amounts of these rocks turned up in the Maria, and breccias had dominated the samples brought back from Fra Mauro. Some were universes in miniature, containing pieces of a host of separate rocks, occasionally even fragments of pre-existing breccias. The information locked in one such sample can keep a geochemist, armed with an electron microprobe, busy for years. Now, as the men drove west, Mulberger could hear Duke describing some nearby boulders. He said he thought they were breccias, too. Via Tony England, Mulberger sent up a question. "Have you seen any rocks that you're certain aren't breccias?"
"Negative," Duke answered.
Well,
Some breaches were to be expected anywhere there were impact craters, and judging from Young and Duke's reports, there were more of them than anyone had expected. The term planes conjures up images of cans and flatness, but at one point John Young said sarcastically, "Cayley, planes. There's nothing planes about this place." Instead, "There's just craters on top of craters." The craters made the driving rough, but even worse, Young couldn't see them as he headed west. With the sun at his back, the landscape was as bright and featureless as a snowfield. All shadows were hidden by the objects that cast them. Mulberger could hear him telling Duke, "This driving down sun is murder." What worried Mulberger, and Young, was that Elston and Boudette had mapped 10 to 16 foot high scarps. So far, though, Young and Duke hadn't reported any. Now, Young and Duke were nearing their objective, a worn 1,000-foot crater called Flag that was big enough to have penetrated deep into bedrock. But how to sample the rocks it brought up? By chance, there was a much smaller, 120-foot, more distinct crater called Plum, right on Flag's rim. Its rim was hoped to be littered with pieces of Flag's ejecta. Those rocks would show what the Cayley Plains were made of. 3:44 p.m., Plum Crater. At Plum, Young and Duke picked up one rock after another and described them all as breaches. Mulberger's team, wondering if they'd misheard, sent a message to Tony England to find out if perhaps they'd found a volcanic rock after all. England didn't want to nag Young and Duke. He was sure that if they'd found one, they would have said something. Meanwhile, Young approached a boulder, hammer in hand, and pried off a piece. The rock was somewhat weak and friable, not hard like basalt. Everyone listening knew that such weakness is typical of rocks that have been through an explosion from a meteorite impact. England asked, "Do you think it's a breccia?" "Yeah, it's a breccia, Houston," said Young. "Or a welded..." Mulberger could hear the words forming on Young's lips, "a welded ash flow tuff, which is a rock made of ash fragments welded together by a matrix of volcanic glass. Welded ash flow tuffs can look just like breccias, and they are rich in silica, just as the Cayley rocks were thought to be. Some of Mulberger's team had predicted there would be welded ash flow tuffs at Descartes." "No, that's not right," Young said. "It's a breccia." In the back room, the question was getting harder to ignore. Where were the volcanic rocks? 4:01 p.m. Ever since Young and Duke arrived at Plum, Mulberger's team had eyed a rock sitting on the crater's east rim, near the rover and its TV camera. They thought they could see a crystal shining through a layer of dust, and that meant it might be igneous. They forwarded the request to Mission Control. "Are you sure you want a rock that big, Houston?" asked Young, mindful of the 200-pound limit on the samples Orion could carry. "That's 20 pounds of rock right there." It turned out closer to 26 pounds, and it was bigger than a football. About a quarter of it had been buried in the dust. To get it, Duke had to get down on his knees, roll the rock up the side of his leg, and then, clutching it to his suit, try to stand up without losing his balance. "If I fall into Plum Crater getting this rock," Duke said with mock annoyance, "Mulberger has had it." It would prove to be the biggest moon rock ever brought back to Earth, and it would be christened Big Muley in honor of Bill Mulberger. The rock was so covered with dust that the men couldn't tell what it was, but Duke ventured that it might be a breccia. 4:47 p.m., Mission Operations Control Room. In Mission Control, Tony England listened to the communications loop as Young and Duke headed back toward Orion to end their first moonwalk. Charlie Duke had been using more cooling water than expected, and Flight Director Pete Frank had decided to trim the second and last geology stop of the day to only 19 minutes. Frustrated by the cutback, Young and Duke were thankful that the driving was easier as they headed east, because they could follow their tracks. At Buster Crater, while Young took readings with a portable magnetometer to record any remnant magnetism in the rocks of the Cayley Plains, Duke had enough time to gather several more samples, Every one was a Breccia, and as he listened, England could not help but feel apprehension for the men at Descartes. 1 month shy of his 30th birthday, with a clear, serious face and wire-rimmed glasses, England looked as though he might be a junior professor in a college science department. In fact, he had a Ph.D. in geophysics, the only geoscientist in the astronaut corps besides Jack Schmidt. Unlike many others in the XS-11 who had immersed themselves in Skylab activities in hopes of improving their chances of flying, England had chosen to stay with Apollo. He knew that in doing so he was probably giving up his chance to fly any time in the near future, but his greatest fascination lay with the moon and the planets. If NASA had not canceled the last 3 lunar landings, England might now be looking forward to going to the moon himself. Instead, as Apollo 16's mission scientist, this seat in mission control was as close as he would get. There were times when the Earth-Moon gap seemed especially vast to England, and one of them had been when the heat flow cable broke. England had not been looking at the screen until it was too late to warn Young. Young hadn't said a word about it since the mishap, but he didn't have to. England knew he must feel absolutely terrible. So must Duke. He had put in a great deal of time training with the drill, and he'd really been looking forward to doing a good job for Mark Langseth. Now, despite the exuberance they'd shown at Plum, Young and Duke were a subdued pair as they drove past the Alsep. England wanted to say something to cheer them both up. "A day ago it didn't look like we were even going to land," he radioed, "and now we've sampled our first Highlands. I feel pretty good about the science without the heat flow." "Well, I know Mark's disappointed," Duke said, "and I sure am." His voice was flat with disappointment. "Me too," Young said. England worried about Young and Duke's morale, even aside from the heat flow accident. The rocks were turning out to be so different from what they had all expected. Were Young and Duke doubting themselves? Were they telling themselves that if they didn't find volcanic rocks, they weren't doing a good job? England could only imagine how big the silence at the other end of the Earth-Moon communications link must feel. He tried to fill it with reassurance. When one of the astronauts made a discovery, England radioed his own enthusiasm. "Outstanding!" And when one of them made a joke, he keyed his mic to broadcast his own laughter. He tried to communicate what he could not say over the air. "Don't worry. You're seeing something we didn't expect. Don't try to make it fit. See what you see and document that. We're going to have to put together a whole new picture of this place because of what you do see." But England need not have worried about Young and Duke. They had seen enough breccias on field trips and in the lunar receiving laboratory to recognize them without hesitation on the moon. They had also seen more volcanic rocks than most field geologists, and there definitely weren't any in sight on the Cayley Plains. And they never doubted themselves. In fact, it occurred to Charlie Duke that the geologists might be doubting what they were hearing. He could imagine them saying to themselves, "My God, we wasted 3 years of training on them." He hoped that wasn't the case. It wasn't. There were some perplexed scientists in the back room, and even a wounded ego or two, but if Mulberger and his team were surprised by the descriptions from the moon, they did not doubt their veracity. Like Scott and Irwin before them, Young and Duke had won the geologists' confidence before they left Earth. The simple fact that they were at the Descartes Highlands, field-checking the volcanic hypothesis, was exciting enough to overshadow the confusion of confronting the unexpected. Soon enough, they would have pieces of the Cayley Plains to study for themselves. On their monitors, Mulberger could see Young, standing in Orion's shadow, using the conveyor line to haul the day's rock box up to Duke. Would those samples disprove the volcanic hypothesis? Today's prospecting had turned up a few rocks that did not seem to be breccias, but they weren't clearly volcanic either. Maybe some welded ash flow tufts would turn up after all. Or maybe the highlands were indeed covered by a surface layer of impact rocks. With so many craters around, that would not be surprising, and there were volcanic flows underneath. If so, the samples in that rock box, now in Duke's hands, would not give the answer. That would have to come from the mission's prime objective, huge North Ray crater, which the geologists hoped would be big enough to have blasted deep into bedrock. North Ray was shaping up as the single destination for a shortened third moonwalk, and tomorrow's excursion to the flanks of Stone Mountain would offer the first chance to probe the riddle of the Descartes Mountains. That moonwalk was now threatened by the possibility that the astronauts might be called on to repair the broken heat flow experiment. Mulberger hated to think of the time that might eat up. In any case, Young and Duke would follow the traverse plan just as they had trained. True, those traverses had been meticulously designed to investigate a volcanic terrain, but there wasn't any way to reframe them now, and even if there had been, no one could think of any better plan. 8:44 p.m. Meanwhile, back in Orion, John Young was worried about orange juice. The NASA doctors had been quite alarmed by Scott and Irwin's heart irregularities on Apollo 15, which they attributed largely to a loss of potassium. To prevent a recurrence on Apollo 16, they added electrolyte to the food, mostly in the form of potassium-spiked orange juice, and they instructed Young, Mattingly, and Duke to drink as much of it as possible. Already that had caused a problem for Charlie Duke. Back in lunar orbit, preparing for the landing, Duke had discovered that every time he moved his head within his bubble helmet, the microphone on his communications hat triggered the valve on the drink bag just below his neck. Before long, Duke found himself staring at a big blob of orange juice floating in front of his face, just out of reach. When it touched the microphone boom, it attached itself and migrated under the fabric of his hat into his hair. By the time he could take off his helmet, after landing, he looked as if he'd been shampooing with orange juice. But the steady diet of potassium-spiked juice had even more unpleasant effects. A few minutes ago, Tony England had passed on word from the medics that the EKGs looked great and added, "Just push on the orange juice." Young drawled, "Push on the orange juice and everything will be fine?" "Yes, push on the orange juice, Roger. I'm going to turn into a citrus product is what I'm going to do." England suppressed a laugh. "Oh, well, it's good for you, John." But Young wasn't kidding. "Ever hear of acid stomach, Tony? I think I've got a pH factor of about 3 right now because of the orange juice." Young was fed up with the havoc being wreaked on his digestive tract. Up in the command module, the three of them had all but overpowered the environmental control system with methane. So far, they'd kept their complaints to themselves, but now, as Young and Duke finished their housekeeping chores for the night, they didn't realize that Young's mic button was stuck in the on position. What came down from the moon was a backstage look at the John and Charlie show. "I got the farts again, Charlie. I don't know what gives them to me. I really don't. I think it's the acid in the stomach. I really do." "Probably is," Duke said. "I mean, I haven't eaten this much citrus fruit in 20 years, but I'll tell you one thing. In another 12 fucking days, I ain't never eating any more. And if they offer to serve me potassium with my breakfast, I'm going to throw up. I like an occasional orange, really do, but I'll be damned if I'm going to be buried in oranges." England beeped his mic button several times to signal the performers, but they kept talking, no longer about oranges, but about the moonwalk they'd just finished. Finally, England spoke up. "Orion, Houston." A crisp response from Young, still unaware. "Yes, sir." "Okay, John, you have a hot mic." Young, more subdued now. How long have we had that?" No one within the sound of Young's voice would forget the episode, including Deke Slayton. He had been sitting next to Tony England throughout the day, keeping watch on the mission, as he had with every important moment of every flight since Young and Gus Grissom flew the first Gemini mission. Now, as Young and Duke prepared for sleep, Slayton manned the Capcom mic for a short time. With his lined face and western shirt, he looked like a cowboy who had seen many hard winters. When he spoke to Orion,